Good evening, everyone. How's everyone tonight? Good. Well, I must say that it's a pleasure to see all of you. It's a real treat to see all of you. Certainly in August, of course. And I have to say that, well, first of all, let me introduce myself. My name is Eric Garcia, and it's been a real delight to be here this week. But we'll talk more about that in a minute. But I wanted to say that when I attend performances, this is one of my favorite parts of the event, is being there where you are, because I love talking about music, I love hearing about music, and I love asking questions about music. So although this is called a pre-concert lecture, I really want to think of it more as a pre-concert conversation. So I want to make sure that I leave time at the end for any questions that you might have. So go ahead and start thinking of questions now, and maybe something I'll say will elicit a question, but we'll certainly make time at the end for that. I was thinking about how to maybe go about doing this tonight. And it's a bit interesting because if I were here as music director, then I think we would jump into the music. And we would talk about the music, and we would talk about the composer, we would talk about the history. But this is a very unique event. I'm visiting your home this week, and you don't really know me. And certainly by the end of the night, we'll know each other pretty well. But because we're really meeting each other, most of us, for the first time, I thought I would just give a little background on who I am, my journey in music, and how I ended up here in Rockford with all of you. Now, of course, you have my bio to read, which is fairly standard, so I thought maybe I should go back pre-bio and give you a little bit more information that I think is so relevant to why I became a musician. So, first of all, I'm from Temple, Texas, which it's a town of about 80 to 85,000 people on Interstate 35. It's the heart of Texas. It's positioned between Waco, Texas and Austin, Texas, so very close to the capital. And I grew up in a non-musical home, meaning that my parents were not musicians. However, they did listen to a lot of music. And as a result, I can't remember a time in my life when I did not hear music of some kind. They did not listen to classical. They listened to popular music, anything popular that was a hit at the time. So lots of LPs, lots of records, and cassette tapes. And they noticed that I would sit for long stretches of time and just listen to the record player. And I have a distinct memory of watching the record just go in circles and circles as I listened, and how exciting that was. The first record that stands out to me was called H2O. I don't know if anyone knows that, but it's by a band called Hall & Oates. Yes, I guarantee you all know the music. Well, I just loved listening to this music. There was so much pleasure that I would get from listening to this album. Now, this was the boom of music television, MTV. And they would play videos 24 hours a day, if you can imagine such a thing. Now, I'm 5 years old, and I plop myself down in front of the television. I have an older brother, so he's making this possible, because he'll turn on the television for me. And I will sit there and watch these videos and listen to this music for, again, it felt like hours. I really couldn't get enough. And thinking back, what's so interesting is I didn't care what the style was. I didn't really understand style at the time. R&B, pop, rock, I didn't know. All I know is I really loved what I heard. And there was something about it that just really captured my imagination and, like I said, really just gave me pleasure. Well, one day I see a video and hear this song. And this moment changed my life in music. And I'd like to think that this moment is one of the reasons why I'm here tonight. So this particular song that I'm going to play a few seconds of starts with a drum solo. And then the drummer starts to play a very sophisticated, difficult beat, but it's very, very catchy. And after that, you'll hear the band come in. How many of us know this song? All right, very good. Good. I'm glad to see that. So, if you don't, it's a band called Toto, wonderful band of the 70s and 80s, and the song is obviously called Rosanna, and the drummer is the genius drummer, and he left us far too soon, Jeff Porcaro. There was something about the way he was playing, there was something about his very sophisticated approach that just caught my imagination. It just happened like that. And from that moment on, I became very kind of entranced by the drummer. So when I would watch videos or when I would listen to LPs, now I'm really honing in on the drummer and what they're doing. Well, soon after, I start hitting on furniture. We had a nice sofa that had a kind of a leather finish that produced a nice snare drum sound like that you just heard. My parents were not happy about this at all. But it was just this natural, organic way for me to now express myself further. So they snapped into action and got a snare drum. Got me taking lessons, still 5 years old, and I learned my basic rudiments. I learned how to roll on the snare. I mean, very difficult things, but it's starting to build this foundation of how to read music. Well, flash forward to 2 years later, age 7, and I get my first drum set. So now I have a full set, toms, bass drum, cymbals, okay. And this is something magical. At this time in school, I'm very quiet. I'm very shy. I'm very introverted. It's very difficult for me to express myself to teachers, to people of my own age. But when I get home, I go straight to the drums, and I play for hours. I'm listening to music, and I'm able to get out everything that I'm feeling inside. And I didn't realize it at the time, but it was a natural extension of who I was becoming. And it was at that moment that I decided that I would have a career in music. I would be a rock drummer. And I was serious. At age 7, that's it. I don't know how it's going to happen. I don't know when and where, but I will be a rock drummer. And so I practiced and practiced and practiced and continued to listen to music, and was, if I may say so, a decent drummer. Okay, so a couple of years go by, and now I'm 10 years old, and I'm driving along with my parents in the car. I'm in the front seat, and they're just kind of fiddling with the radio station, and they're going through the channels, and we pass by the local classical music station. And I say to them, whoa, stop. Can you go back to that station, that whatever that was? We go back, and we listen to it. Now, to this day, I don't know the work. I don't know what was playing. I don't know the composer. All I know is, just like when I was 5 years old, listening to these various styles of pop music, something just ignited inside of me. And I became entranced now with all of these sounds coming from this orchestra, the different instruments, this wide dynamic range, which I was not hearing in pop and rock music. But it became something that was inspirational at the right time. My parents are quite relieved because as much as they love popular music and they love me playing drums, now they see that maybe the tide is turning, so they start to encourage me to listen to classical music and start piano lessons. So very soon after, I start visiting the local community college, Temple Community College. Now it's Temple College. And my father and I go, and we walk out with armfuls of LPs. And they are covered in this very thick plastic cover to help, you know, maintain its life. And we're walking out with these. And it's Mozart, it's Wagner, it's Tchaikovsky, it's everything. I also start taking texts off of the stacks, off the shelves, about music history, about the lives of the composers. Also, they have a section for orchestral scores. And the first time you see an orchestral score is something that you never forget. Because I was blown away by the pure visual aspect of it. Of course, there are all of these instruments. But when you see the Rite of Spring, in particular the sacrificial dance, the great finale of the Rite of Spring, when you see it on the page for the first time, it will change your life. The pure artistic look of it, the architecture of all of these many, many notes, was something I'll never forget. And so I became a sponge, an obsessed sponge, that would listen and listen. And again, this somehow became the way I felt that I could express myself. I began composing at, let's say, 12 years old. And no one told me to compose. No one knew how to compose in my life. But I felt the need to try to write a symphony. Because I was listening, it seemed perfectly natural. And I would write whatever style I was listening to. So maybe there was a piece that sounded like West Side Story. Maybe there was a piece that sounded like Appalachian Spring, perhaps The Marriage of Figaro. I started two operas, by the way, that you can't hear any of them because I only got 5 minutes into each one. But an opera in the style of Mozart, an opera in the style of Wagner. So this was me starting to really learn how to express who I was. And finding an outlet, which at that age is so incredibly important. Well, one weekend I'm staying at my grandparents' home, and I'm listening to the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. Isaac Stern is performing. And I start waving my arms. I've seen conductors on television, Bernstein, Maida, Ormandy, but now I'm waving my arms to this music. And again, it seemed like an organic event. No one told me to do it, but it seemed right. It seemed the thing to do. And it was soon after that I committed myself to, well, the conductor seems to be in this Goldilocks zone. You have creating the product, the composition over here, and over here you have the performance aspect. And I was doing both, but there was something about conducting that seemed to be perfectly in the middle of this, the conduit, if you will. And so I said, well, of course, now I will be a professional conductor. And at age 12 and 13, there was really not much guidance in Temple, Texas for how to do this. And I'm bothering people and wind conductors and orchestra directors, and all they can say is, wait until college. Well, I find a way to conduct my my middle school band and warm-ups and do things like that. And then I wait for college. And I enter the University of Texas as a composition major because, thankfully, you cannot get an undergrad degree in conducting. That would be like putting a 10-year-old behind the wheel of a Rolls Royce. I don't have a good feeling about it. And so, but you can start taking conducting classes in your undergrad, which I did. But I composed, and I knew that I was going to go on to conduct. Well, somewhere around my sophomore year in college, I realized that if my own compositions didn't sound like Shostakovich circa World War II or neoclassical Stravinsky, then I would toss it out. And I realized I'm not a composer, because a composer has a unique voice. They have to express themselves with their notes. And so I switched to music theory full-time, which seemed like the right thing to do for conducting. And I put on recitals. You buy pizza and soda, and your musicians perform for you. And you get videotape footage of it. And I submitted that. And I applied all over the country to various schools. I had a top choice, and that was Northwestern University. The very formidable Victor Yampolsky was teaching, and he was a tough guy. He was going to be a very tough teacher if I should get into his studio. And I knew that. But I wanted to study with him. And I auditioned for him, and I met him, and I looked at him through his glasses, and he looked at me, and we seemed to hit it off. My years with Victor Yampolsky at Northwestern, just down the road, were life-changing in a different way. I realized that the conducting world has many paths. You can go into academia, you can be a college professor, director of orchestral activities, you can teach conducting to young conductors, or you can go the more professional route and become an assistant conductor of a major orchestra, and then go on to be a music director. Looking back, I'm so very fortunate that, like the music I listened to at 5, and like the classical music I was starting to listen to at 12, I didn't really see much of a difference. It seemed like the same world, the same music world. As a result, I've been able to do both. I've been very fortunate. I've directed university orchestras. I've taught young conductors this summer, actually, just about a month and a half ago. And, of course, I'm music director right now, and I was assistant conductor in the Seattle Symphony, or with the Seattle Symphony. And so I feel so fortunate that all of that has somehow gotten me here with you tonight, and gotten me here to be in front of this amazing orchestra that you have here in Rockford. The program this evening traverses a very interesting path, and I'm going to talk more about each piece throughout the concert, but I just wanted to listen to a few moments of the very opening of Brahms Symphony No. 4, because I do want to leave some time for questions. Whenever I conduct this piece, I have this written in my score, a quote by the great conductor Hans von Bülow. He was a colleague of Brahms, and he was conducting this symphony for the first time. It was a new symphony. And he uttered these words after a couple of rehearsals. He said, "Difficult, very difficult. Symphony No. 4. Gigantic, altogether a law unto itself, quite new, steely individuality, exudes unparalleled energy from the first note to the last." Now, I have that in my score because we've now performed this work as a society thousands and thousands of times. We know it very well. But in the 137 years that separate that quote from today, nothing has changed. It is such a masterwork that all of that holds true. This piece is incredibly difficult on a technical level to put together. It is gigantic, really in an emotional sense. It's a bit of a mountain that you have to climb to get through the various emotions that Brahms seems to just take to their limit. It is a law unto itself. Brahms is able to have the present, past, and future coexist very peacefully in this work. And it exudes unparalleled energy from the first note to the last. And it's those first few notes that I wanted to just listen to a little, because it's one of the most famous openings in classical music. Brahms begins the symphony, he seems to be in a bit of an anxious rush. He can't seem to get there fast enough. There seems to be something that Brahms needs to attend to. There is a concern. And so the symphony begins, like I said, without an introduction, just like this. So we are, from the very beginning, in the middle of the melody. We are the melody once we begin. And if we notice, by looking at it a little bit more closely, it's not really a long, overarching melody in a conventional sense. As a matter of fact, it's made up of these obsessive little two sets of notes. Descending, ta-di, ascending, ta-dim, descending, ti-dom, ascending, ta-dim. So there is this feeling of conversation. And as a matter of fact, this is the most conversational of Brahms' symphonies. There is never a moment in the symphony where you don't feel like you are hearing a conversation, intimate or on a grand scale. So if we listen to it again, I want you to listen to this idea. I don't know if it's right, but it's my take on it. There's a statement, ti-dom, and then a question, ta-dim, and then the statement again, ti-da, question, ta-dim, and now a statement even more firm, assertive, ti-a, question again, ti-da, and then question again. So the conversation asks so many questions. Statement, reply, statement, more firm, and again. So we are what seems like a very intimate conversation between two people, two entities of sorts. For sake of time, I want to jump ahead to how Brahms concludes this most amazing of first movements, because he does so in a way that creates a tumultuous finale, a truly tumultuous finale. And he does it with what other than this opening theme, ta-dim, pam-pam. But now, as we've reached the climax of this first movement, there seems to be, even though we're hearing this conversation, it's confrontational. And there seems to be a breakdown in communication. And Brahms has built the intensity level to such a breaking point that we're very, very concerned about this conversation that we're hearing. Thank you. there seems to be a never-ending volume switch or a never-ending ability to build the anxiety or feeling of just unease in this movement. We'll encounter this in the finale, which certainly was one of the most uncompromising finales of its time. I'll talk more about it at the concert, but what I want to say about this particular symphony is we are hearing Brahms in a very different light than his first symphony in C major, than his pastoral symphony in D major, than his fairly optimistic and sometimes pastoral third symphony. This is Brahms writing in E minor, and you feel a gravitas and a yearning for something. And what is it that Brahms is looking for or yearning for? What kind of communication is he trying to achieve? And as a listener, it's really up to us to make that decision ourselves. We don't know. For sake of time, I do want to make sure that we have just a few minutes. It appears we have about 3 minutes. But nevertheless, I hate to hog the time myself, as we would say in Texas. So I would love, if anyone has a question, to just raise your hand. And just, if you don't mind standing up, or you can stay seated and just ask the question. I'll do the best I can to get to a few before we leave. Yes, first, right here, but then back here, there was the question first. So the question is, what kind of thought process goes into putting together a program? That's a wonderful question. And I will talk about it in just a few minutes. But for me, I really wanted to ensure that, of course, we had a significant work on the program, because there was a week for the two of us to get to know one another. And so you want a significant work to play. And so for me, Brahms Symphony No. 4 was the absolute perfect work to do so. Of course, we wanted a concerto on the program. And as we'll talk about in the concert, there's a very interesting connection between Erich Korngold and Johannes Brahms. And there's also a very interesting connection that we're going to discover between Erich Korngold and John Williams. So in this particular instance, it was a matter of, well, let's find an opener, a concerto, and a symphony, so we can all get to know one another, so you can get to know me. But I wanted to see a theme that ran through, a thread that went through that. So I promise you'll get even more of an answer over the next couple of hours. Thank you so much. Yes, there is a right here.
As a very young drummer, I'm wondering if here you've met Buddy Carlos.
So Buddy Carlos, the question is, have I met him? If anyone doesn't know, he is the drummer for Cheap Trick, which I think we all know Cheap Trick, Rockford native. And the question is, no, we've never met, but I was an admirer of his growing up, and of course Cheap Trick is one of our great rock bands, so thank you for that question. Yeah. That's a deep dive, I like that one. We probably have time for one more question. Yes, right here. So the question is, or the statement in question is, we've all heard Brahms for many times. Maybe some of us are hearing it for the first time, and I wish I were you. I can't imagine hearing this piece for the first time again. My God, what a gift. But what will be different tonight? My attempt in Brahms 4, anytime I conduct Brahms, but in particular number 4, is to take him at his word. Brahms writes with such unique detail in the score. So accents, staccato marks, tempo changes, tempo indications. Brahms has a tendency to overstate. And we can connect that to his personality and to his just way of living. But Brahms is so prodigious in how much information he gives us. The problem with Brahms 4 is, if you've played it many times, you just play it. It really takes kind of taking off those layers that sometimes grow on a painting and just kind of getting rid of them and saying, well, sure, this has grown over time, but that's not exactly the true color and shade of this painting. And so for me, it's stripping down habits, stripping down things that I've done in the past, and looking at the score and saying, Johannes Brahms suffered to give me this symphony. The least I can do and the least we can do for a mitzvah is to do everything we can to present the work as I feel he would have wanted. So I endeavor to remain true to his word. Yes. And because you have such an incredible orchestra, it's much easier to do so. So you know this because you're here for every concert. But before I leave, I just want to let you know, I have such limited time with them. You know, 4 rehearsals, that's not much. But the amount of interaction with them, they play like chamber musicians. They want to collaborate. They want to dig into the music and find something new. I just want to tell you that something you already know, you have an incredible orchestra in your beautiful community. So I hope you enjoy this evening's performance. Thank you for listening to my story, whatever it may be. And I certainly hope we can talk more after the performance. So thank you so much, everyone. Thank you.